All right, hello everybody. I'm here today with David Vai. He's the director of technical marketing for the AWR Group, and they're a part of National Instruments now, if I understand correctly.
Hi, Andrew. Yeah, that's exactly. I'm with the National Instruments, the AWR Group. Yep.
Okay. And so, have you always been with AWR, or did you kind of move into the or were you with National Instruments and moved into the AWR role after the fact?
I joined the National Instruments Group after they acquired AWR, which was in 2011.
Okay.
I started my career, first job out of college was with MACOM.
Okay.
In the mid-80s, and then I went to Raytheon, where I was with a research division group for a while.
Okay.
And then from there, I joined Ansoft, which got me into, I was an RF design engineer, and then that got me into product marketing eventually. And then from that, I leveraged that job into, I was the editor at Microwave Journal for
years.
So I was, as part of my marketing role with Ansoft, I was liaisoning with a lot of the media, the trade magazines from our industry. And so I then took a position as the editor there, and was there for about 7 years, and then jumped back into the industry, and ended up with AWR, where I've been for about 3.5 years now.
Oh, fantastic. So you said MACOM, Raytheon, Ansoft. Were you in Boston for that time? Because I think those were all based out of there.
I've been in Boston my entire career. I was born in Western Mass, and I've lived out my life in Boston area. Yeah.
Oh, cool. So I guess I missed you. I just moved to Texas in January.
Okay. Yeah. I was here, during that time when people kind of migrated between Raytheon, MACOM, and Alpha, which is now Skyworks.
Yeah.
People, kind of bounce around between those three companies, and I hit two out of the three.
Yeah. So where did you go to school, and were you microwave engineering or?
Yeah, I went to at the time it's called Southeastern Mass University. It's now UMass Dartmouth, I was fortunate. We had a professor there in charge of the microwave engineering school named Peter Rizzi. And Dr. Rizzi wrote a very nice book. He was actually writing it while we were students there, on microwave theory. So he's very, very knowledgeable, very practical guy. And he actually has some role, I think, in the founding of Alpha Industries. Mm-hmm. So, he was a really good instructor and got me excited about microwaves as a discipline. And he also had industry connections, which was how I ended up with my first job, was through one of his contacts it was at MACOM, but yeah.
Cool. So what were you working on kind of in the earlier portion of your career when you're still doing the heavy duty technical stuff?
Yeah. I graduated in 84 and started in 85. And at that time, a lot of us were involved in that emerging world of gallium arsenide and MMIC, which seems like a staple now in our industry, but at the time it was a lot of new things going on. It was the Reagan years and the Cold War, so there was a lot of defense money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was initially one of my early jobs was working with the MACOM. It was called Advanced Semiconductor Operator up in Lowell, and it was their gas fab. And we had a MMIC group, and I was part of the power amplifier and FET characterization group.
Okay.
So, my first jobs were in the test lab and developing processes for characterizing FETs. And, they were power FETs, so we're trying to figure out ways to qualify our gas process and determine, what was going on with the process through different measurements that we could do in situ. And then I leveraged that into doing MMIC design and was a MMIC designer at MACOM, and then went over to Raytheon Research, and I was part of the IMPAT diode group. So we're doing a lot of development work for a lot of government contracts, but Ku-band and Q-band. I helped build a Q-band power amplifier based on impact diode technology. Mm-hmm. It was a 60 gigahertz amplifier that NASA had contracted.
Wow.
Proof of concept. So yeah, some pretty good stuff, and you know, that was quite a while ago. But
so what were sort of the applications back then for the mimics that you were working on?
These were SATCOM applications and proof of concept. IMPAT at that time, IMPAT was the technology that Raytheon was going to, I think they were going to go up against, Hughes, mm-hmm. Contract, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And prior to my joining, Hughes had won the contract. And so sort of the IMPAT diode effort at Raytheon got backburnered. So we were just kind of doing odd things for like China Lake and in my case NASA. So it was still, you know, power amplifiers, but diode based. High power FETs weren't really an option.
Yeah.
They weren't a viable technology back in the mid to late 80s. Certainly has changed.
What did the design tools look like back in the 80s, I can't even imagine. Like, they're so advanced now. You can, like, rotate the chip and do all this fancy stuff. And I see the artwork of the mimics back then, and I'm like, did they just literally, like, just use a calculator? And
yeah, old school stuff. But fun. Back then, super compact on a mainframe, netlist-based. Yeah, I can remember people who, you know, when schematic capture came out, they didn't like it because they could type faster than they could, you know, drag and drop components.
Yeah.
It was timeshare time. Not that all. I mean, things were evolving. When I first started, like the 8510 network analyzer had just come around, so you know, the VNA was a pretty important advancement for product development, at least in the test lab side, and then super compact, and then they introduced harmonic balance, so now you could do nonlinear simulation, and then around the same time, ESOF came out, the PC computer was starting to get big, so that was competitive advantages to put all that on a PC, and it was wildly successful, and then a lot of people migrated to an ESOF solution, and Yeah, it was interesting times though.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, I know we want to talk today about, I don't know if it's the right time to launch into it, but how the simulation technology has just gone so far compared to what I'm sure it was back then.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mentioned I was with the Impact Diode Group, and what we did is the diode would go into a cavity, the cavities would go onto magnetic keys that would come on and make magnetic keys. Binary combination as you went through the amplifier chain to get yourself up into like kilowatts at millimeter wave frequencies, but the splitter would be a magic T with a cone shape thing, and that was highly our process for designing that in the past was we had a dedicated machine shop, you know, and we'd do drawings and send it down, and the machine guys would make a range of perturbations on a different parameter, and we just put them together and test them. And I remember when I was there, Hewlett Packard invited us to come to an informational session on a new technology called HFSS. And they show, we were obviously interested in that, if it was going to save us from the week that it would take to get parts back from the machine lab, but I'd have to say it was a challenge because these things worked on big Unix machines, and you had to reserve time on them. You had a whole facility of engineers wanting to do their design, so you set something up over the weekend, come back, and to find out it crashed and we had no thoughts.
It's not much different now. It's just that now we do much more complicated solutions. I'm guessing now we're trying to simulate like a fifth gen fighter or something, the antenna placement, but they still did the same stuff where it's a bunch of people sharing a supercomputer and batch jobs.
Right. Yeah, I think that will be the one constant, that what you're able to simulate and what you want to simulate, you'll always be playing that cat and mouse game.
Yeah.
As soon as you have more power to simulate more, you'll want to simulate more. And which is, that's a good thing for the people in the simulation world, but also for the designers. You know, it's amazing what you can do now, but you know, it was pretty, by today's standards, very primitive. But you know, it was the beginning of what you know, would be what we have today. So it was nice to witness. It was fun to see the evolution.
Yeah. So it started, so you're doing a lot of SATCOM stuff, it sounds like. Were you doing any sort of radar or phased array type work?
Not me per se. I mean, I've worked at the component level throughout my career, right? So, you know, I'm not doing integration. I didn't, you know, really see things from the system side. I knew that, you know, there are other people that I worked with who were, you know, doing some integration, you know, doing phased array tile work. And I you know, saw it over the shoulder some of that. You know, I was more focused on PA design. When I was at Raytheon, towards the end of my time at Raytheon, the 2G was starting to hit. And, you know, so we're getting into digital modulation for the first time. And, you know, we had an HBT process, so we were trying to build HBT power amplifiers for TCS systems and stuff. So some more communication stuff at that phase. Although I would say we did have a contract with New Japan Radio for 60 gigahertz automotive radar, which was way ahead of its time for, you know, where we are today with the podcast. I'm not at 60, but So, you know, I'd be at the component level, but stuff would be targeted probably towards radar for support.
Nice. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the need for phased array and radar has always been sort of geared towards the government sector, but especially in recent years, and you probably know more about this than I do because I'm back in the government side of things and you have more exposure to the commercial sector. But do you think there's a kind of a next wave of radar and phased array technology being adopted by the commercial industry?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. You know, and it's refreshing to see. I mean, I think that's always been the case with the technology. The government has the deeper pockets and the need to develop systems that the private sector probably can't address. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, GPS is a great example. You know, I don't think any single entity would have done that. And our aerospace defense systems are, you know, quite complex undertaking for individual companies. But yeah, now you know, clearly the things that come to mind immediately are, you know, 5G is going to be predicated on the need for grid scaling. You know, they're going to, you know, driven by the need for capacity and data rates. You know, you got to find, you know, new bandwidth, and you're going to find that bandwidth at higher frequencies in the millimeter wave spectrum. And therefore, the problem with millimeter wave is the high propagation losses that you incur. So you got to be efficient about your, you know, how you your beam scaling and your antenna. All stuff that the defense systems have implemented for years, you know, is now being driven by a need on the commercial side.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, certainly 5G is one, and then the other one is automotive radar for ADAS systems. And, you know, you need millimeter wave for the high resolution that you need to detect targets or multiple targets and all the noise and clutter that you can imagine, you know, will occur in traffic. No, I was just going to say, yeah, so we're looking, you know, commercially, I think those two things are driving. I mean, I think there's a great hand-in-hand partnership between, you know, defense funding, you know, goes and goes down, and someone who's been in the defense industry knows. And it seems to magically kind of ramp up on the commercial side. So, you know, I think the two complement each other very well.
Yeah.
And if there's, you know, maybe with government contracts, there's not as much drive to knock down the price as there is on the commercial side.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the defense side is a beneficiary of some of the things that are driving commercial moves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what is what's AWR doing right now to help those commercial guys out to, I guess, predict the performance so they're not spending all this money doing multiple hardware spins and these sorts of things?
Well, you know, we have a so like what we were talking about before with that, you know, the, you know, you're given more simulation power and you're going to simulate more things with it. I think that's kind of a truism throughout the EDA industry that, we're supporting electronic design and it just gets more and more complicated, requiring more and more simulation power. In terms of accuracy, in terms of simulating, we're simulating bigger problems. A lot to do with automation. We're sharing data across a lot of platforms, a lot of different data sources. In our field, system level, circuit level, and EM simulation, they need to all kind of work together closely, seamlessly. That's a capability that's been there for some time, but how it gets applied keeps changing and evolving. Distributed computing plays a role in that. In particular in phased array, we have a really interesting proprietary, and I think it's a unique capability, it's our phased array wizard. In which somebody can kind of, it's like a toolbox that somebody can configure a phased array and, take elements and very quickly specify the arrangement and the, element spacing and how they align to each other, and then assign a radiation pattern from either another simulation or measurement to any individual or all of them, those elements. And then define details about the feed networks, gain tapering, very high level way to put together, construct an abstract phased array, but that's built on real stuff like radiation patterns that you would expect off a single path within that array.
Yeah, I've been very happy to see kind of a coming together of the system level sort of stuff and the component level stuff, because you always have your system guy and he's running off of his spreadsheet and the component guy does his simulation. And those numbers from the component guy usually feed into the spreadsheet. But first of all, there's always the configuration management problem, right? And like the sheet's not always completely up to date and these sorts of things. But then also that's, you get much more fidelity when it's a full integrated simulation, I feel.
Yeah, I think so, for sure. And that's a challenge, not a technical challenge, but a commercial challenge for us is, we're Excel spreadsheets are everyone's got Excel on their computer.
Yeah.
We have a product that's, a lot more sophisticated and can do a lot more. But part of what it does is do that spreadsheet function, and budget analysis. And it's kind of the starting point for specing out all the parts and then distributing what those specs to do to the team. But essentially going up against free software is a hard sell for a single product. But, our system tool does a lot more than that. And, the phased array wizard is what we call that particular function. It's quite impressive. I'm not I never did any phased array design when I was a working engineer. I do it now as part of part of my job is developing content, and applications that we write about. And I find it useful for me to use our own tools to develop some of that, to become aware of, what it's capable of and what we can do. I find it really fun. It's like, wow, yeah, this is kind of fun. I'm building an array and it works. As an example, recently, a company that we partner with does a beamforming IC. And I'm really interested in how that commercial market is taking off. This particular company is an Oki Wave, but there's a number of them out there. Not a lot, but there are a couple of them. And you know, just modeling the device, you know, at a system level and a tool, and then populating I built a 128 element array with a behavioral version of their IC, 32 of them driving the 128. And it was fun. I mean, just to build that out and what the tools can do as an engineer, it was gratifying.
Yeah. So did you find that you got good agreement between what you were measuring and what you were simulating?
Well, I got spot on because I put in that, I'm working from a data sheet. So, that's the beauty of a system tool, and you're just working with numbers, So the real challenge, and, obviously is as we start to physically realize these things, and that's mm-hmm. where a lot of our focus on the simulation comes into play, and EM is critical in that. And you start from people still need to have good solid engineering skills. You work from you build it up in layers. You work from, okay, here's my transistor model, bias it up, test it, compare it to what it should do. Okay, it's implemented correctly. Okay, now let's start building a bias network and a network and a matching network for that. That's where I spent a lot of my engineering time, was doing PA design and matching networks. And I do get a kick out of the Smith chart. I mean, I think
it works.
Cool. Yeah, it's just incredible. It's really fun to use, and it's to have an electronic version of that and tuning. And we have a capability called network synthesis. That's kind of a newer area that we're getting into. It had always been our sort of vision that that's what we would do as a software company. Would kind of emulate the things that you do as a real engineer. And we introduced that with Microwave Office, its very first product, with real-time tuning. Mm-hmm. The view that, when you're in a lab,
Love that feature.
Right, you have ways to tune things, right? You watch the response on the spectrum analyzer or the VNA, and you tune things to dial them into what they need to do. And we just created a virtual version of that.
I never even thought of that. That's what that was like moving the piece of copper tape up and down or whatever. So I didn't think of it as I thought it was just a natural tool to have in a simulator. But yeah.
Yeah, no, it's natural because you've done it before, and so it felt very natural. You knew the experience, and we implemented that in software, and it was popular for that reason, I think. And network, and the other end of the design process at the very start is I got to design an amplifier. Or whatever it is. I think most times people go to what they did last and start from there, and then mm-hmm. move it forward. Yeah. Or you've got to go to a textbook and look something up, or with an amplifier. For me, amplifier example is, you figure out the biasing, you bias it, you look at the S parameters, and you start doing matching from your band. So we've automated that process with our synthesis technology that we've been developing. And part of that development has been internal, some of it's been through acquisition. About 3 years ago, we acquired a very interesting technology based on genetic algorithms that can really explore the design space. It was originally applied to antennas, so it's an antenna synthesis tool. But now we have a version that synthesizes impedance matching networks, and so the user can specify, the two networks that need to be matched, or one of them might be a set of load pull contours, mm-hmm. Or you might match to 50 ohms. And then you're kind of specifying how many segments you need to match. I'd like to do a nice broadband match, so I'd go with more segments. I just came back from Asia, where they're trying to cut costs. So, no engineer worth the salt is going to match anything with more than three, because, you're trying to get your bill of materials down.
Yeah.
But that stuff can be incorporated into the intelligence of simulation, and trying to take over the more menial things that engineers do is one of the things that software, if it's built right, will target doing.
But at the end of the day, you still need to know what you're doing, which is the nice thing. I don't think engineers need to worry about losing their job to these optimizers or anything, because I know HFSS is not your product, but you could you could draw something and it can have like 20 different variables that you need to tweak, right? So you could stupidly throw all those in the optimizer and come away with nothing.
Yeah.
First of all, each simulation takes at least a couple of minutes, and then, you know, you have no idea what the sensitive variables are and stuff like that. So you still need to know what you're doing.
You raise a very, very valid point, and I can't emphasize it enough. Engineers need to know what they're doing. In my position at the Microwave Journal, I like to say I'm still a consulting editor, so I go in on a monthly basis to review papers for consideration to publish. And yeah, there's, you know, easy rejection if you've just, you know, you've optimized everything and you don't really have any solid design theory behind what you're doing.
That all being said, the universities could probably shift away a little bit from focusing so much on just like doing integrals and stuff like that and helping mm-hmm. to build the intuition instead. Like, we have these tools that can crunch those numbers. We don't need to be able to do all that stuff anymore. I think it's time to build the intuition of the engineers but just so they know what they do need to put into these software tools now.
Yeah, that's just my opinion. Yeah, and I think you're both on right. You know, how both points. You need to find a good balance between understanding how things work, and then, you know, if automation can relieve you from the tedium of that, so you can focus on the engineering part of it.
Right.
And we try to do that. And definitely, you know, for any engineer, you know, who's listening and you know, particularly, you know, once you're just starting off, is you got to know those basics. And anyone who tries to, I mean, I'm guilty of this too. You want to put it all together and turn it on and hope you can do that. And then you're going to reverse engineer till you find out, you know, where you made a mistake. But, you know, the other way to go is methodically, you know, put it together, put, you know, building blocks and confirm that you've done that part right. And then you can move on to the next step.
You got it. We're not software guys. If we don't hit F5 and watch it crash, we turn the power switch and watch it go up in flames.
Yeah.
It's more expensive that way.
I did a nice project. I know, you know, we're focused mostly on radar and phased array, but there are filters in phased arrays. And I did a nice project last year with Dan Swanson, who's a filter guru, former MACOM guy, Cobham guy. He's now a consultant on his own. And he's built an optimizer that plugs into, it sits on top of the AWR products. And it's a filter optimizer, but the thing that he's got to his benefit is that filter equations are very mathematical. And so he can really well predict. So instead of like a 20 parameter blind optimizer, it's kind of like a smart optimizer. And we've combined that with, using parametrics that are, you know, a key part of our tools. And when I say parametrics, when you enter in a part, you know, you can parameterize its value. So a capacitor could be 12 picofarads, or it could be cap one, and you can sweep cap one, right? And that's how you do a lot of design, by parameterizing things. And that's, you know, tuning is based on that. Mm-hmm. So he's able to take that that's tied into our EM simulation tools and his optimizer, and with the math behind, you know, all the math that's behind modern filter theory, produce a very efficient optimizer for filter design.
Nice.
And we did a nice project, and we wrote it up. It's like a cookbook. It was in the Microwave Journal as an article, technical article, I think March or April. I think it might be April. You know, I think it's a good study in how microwave engineering should work. You know, you need to know the fundamentals. The tools are their tools.
Mm-hmm.
The real knowledge lies with the engineer.
Right.
And they have to know how that works. You know, the EM simulator is going to tell you, you know, how that post resonates, at what frequency, and how it interacts with the post next to it.
Mm-hmm.
You do the study to figure out how you're going to configure them and create a narrow band filter at millimeter wave, which is going to be, you know, back to our subject at hand, commercial applications for phased array and radar. Is, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of activity at millimeter wave.
Mm-hmm.
And there are going to be a lot of challenges with that. You know, very, very tight tolerances, going to require very exacting engineering. Mm-hmm.
So how do you think we're equipped to take those challenges on?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of the tools. It's a combination of the people. I think, I've met some very nice, very smart, energetic individuals in the industry. I think it's been an aging industry, but I love going to, like, we'll have IMS in Boston next month, and I expect to see a lot of, you know, kids that are coming out of university or have, you know, been working maybe a year or two. Mm-hmm. That's where I place my hope, that, you know, these people like this technology and embrace it, and we get enough of them graduating, and that they're the right jobs for them, and they choose it. I know it's been an issue, and I know that a lot of activity has gone into trying to recruit and educate, you know, to make sure that there are enough RF engineers, you know, people with our discipline to do this kind of work. But, you know, I'm encouraged that they'll be there, and we have a good solid university program at both NI and AWR. Mm-hmm. Where our software is available to students, to enrolled students, and to
You took care of me. I remember. Okay.
There you go.
I had the free license. I even beta tested some of the envelope simulator stuff for power amplifiers.
Okay. Were you doing commercial work, or at that time, or just?
Yeah, I was doing commercial work at the time. Wow. Well, so we were funded by a DARPA program, but it was. Okay. It was envelope tracking, which was obviously going right into LTE stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah. I think, you know, we'll figure it out. We're engineers, right?
So that's right. Well, great. I don't want to take too much more of your time. Do you have any kind of final parting thoughts you'd like to share with the audience?
I just like to say I stumbled upon your podcast from maybe a couple months ago, and I appreciate that you reached out and we were able to connect, and that you offered me the opportunity to talk with you and maybe share hopefully some insights on what we do in this field. I was at the phased array event. It's every 2 years, I believe, right?
So I think it's every three.
Wait, yeah. So yeah, the 2016 when it was in Boston. I went to that, and I remember sitting in on a session with Gabe Rabiz, who's a distinguished professor at UC San Diego. Mm-hmm. And he's a huge proponent of phased array and knows so much on the topic. But he was talking about the commercial implications of what it's going to be able to do, and its market size, and comparing it. I just remember him drawing circles that, you know, the size was relative to the market size from his, you know, very rough visualization of what he was talking about. It's enormous what the commercial opportunities are going to be for this technology. And I do believe him, and we're being blown away. And it was a great conference. And I encourage anyone who's in the Boston area at that time to go to it, because it's a great opportunity to hear things like that that are truly, you know, just, I had no idea, you know, you think it's going to be big, and then you hear somebody tell you how big, and you know, so it's a great event for context, for meeting people. Boston's a great place to be, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to some of your potential attendees.
Great. Thanks a lot, David.
Okay, thank you, Andrew.
All right.
Bye-bye.